title of the talk tonight is Relieve Me of the Bondage of Self, which, considering the discussion we just had, is perfect, because when I'm in the moment of being relieved of the bondage of self, I don't have to worry about any of these technological issues or how it might appear. So, great topic. I wanted to start with a teaching from a master that I've had the privilege to sit with. His name is Ajahn Sumedho, and he's a Westerner who's studied extensively in Thailand in the Thai Forest tradition under Ajahn Chah. And he has a monastery in England, and it's just a very bright, radiant fountain of wisdom. He says, "We create personalities out of our thoughts, most of which are based upon extremes, which makes us neurotic." And then he says, "This is a practice of not going to extremes. Extremes of I want, extremes of I don't want, not making problems out of things." I love that, not making problems out of things. So it got me to reflecting a little bit about practice on this retreat for me, and offering some reflections for you this evening as you listen to the talk, and for the rest of the retreat, just how often are you making a problem out of things? And when is there the acceptance that suddenly the problem becomes no problem, this moment of grace? It's a really interesting thing for me to track in my practice. Where's the line between, you know, breakfast being late, being a problem, and then just that waiting practice that I was just talking about, and then no problem? You know, when does the mind fall into just the ultimate neurotic mind stream while we're sitting here, and then all of a sudden you notice an in-breath. There it is. You just woke up. So for your reflection about how these thought processes of creating problems and letting the problems dissolve, of falling into our addictive feeling, and then coming home to an in-breath, where's the bondage of self? And where is the relief from the bondage of self? I actually also think of it as the release from the bondage of self, because one of my teachers has a mantra that's really hit home for me, that this practice is about release, not relief. So I hold relief and release interchangeably when I look at this teaching in the Big Book of Relieve Me of the Bondage of Self, because I think it's pointing to both. So for me, when I came into the Buddha Dharma, I actually had a moment of, well, many moments of relief. One of the moments of relief was actually realizing that I had not one, but two diseases. And actually for me, that was like this huge relief. Because when I first heard the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, and heard about just the fact that being a human being, living a life, there's going to be things aren't always satisfactory. Suffering comes for no other reason than we get old and we die. And that there's a cause to it, which is this craving. And I could just tap right into that. I was like, oh, I not only have the disease of addiction, of alcoholism, and of the craving that that brings, that really extreme craving, but I have like this disease of humanity. I get to be included in the realm of humanity. I don't just have to be stuck out there, this, idea of getting into the idea of being a lonesome alcoholic who feels really comfortable in the rooms, but out in the rest of the world, you know, there's this disease and how people relate to that disease if they don't understand. It's like we all have a disease. We're all included, some to a greater degree and some to a lesser degree. And we, you know, see the greater and lesser degrees of our diseases in the rooms as well as just in humanity. So for all of us who are not fully enlightened, you know, we get to take some medicine for these diseases and these practices and these steps. This is from How It Works. Above everything, we alcoholics and addicts must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. A higher power makes that possible. We must, or it kills us. You know, and we know that. We know that. And I feel like we're actually so lucky, those of us who have these kind of extreme levels of addiction and have seen them, because, you know, we don't have the privilege of resting on our laurels. You know, we don't have the privilege of, you know, kind of the rest of folks on the planet who could say, oh yeah, you know, this craving, it's causing me some discomfort, but, you know, I really like to, you know, turn on the television or just kind of space out, or, you know, all the different things that we just do in extremes, even if we're not addicts, to disconnect, to not wake up. We don't have that privilege, you know. We're nothing if not motivated, because it's a life or death issue. And for me, that actually gives me a ton of juice in practice, because I know that it's a life or death issue, that I continue working the steps. But I also know that it's a life and death issue that I continue for myself this practice of meditation, of ethical conduct, of developing skillful intention and wisdom. That it's actually a life or death issue, that I can just say, oh, I'd rather not. I'm tired, I'm bored, I'm this, I'm that. I'd rather not. But Kevin talked about yesterday, you know, the preciousness of being a human being, living a life in contact with teachings of truth. And this Dharma and the 12 steps are teachings of truth. It's like, what grace. What grace. Half measures availed us nothing. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked for protection and care with complete abandon. Not partial abandon, but complete abandon. Sometimes when I'm sitting in meetings, and that's read, I really, whenever How It Works starts to be read, I just close my eyes. Even if I don't close my eyes, even if they're open, it's like an internal going inward and catching that moment of, you know, may you find him now. In that split second pause, there's an invitation. It's a very short invitation in some meetings, but it's there. And I really always feel in my body that half measures availed us nothing. Which points to that complete willingness to do whatever it takes to wake up. You know, to be free from the bondage of self. You know, this self-centeredness, which is much of the root of our many versions of the disease in this room. And it's really neat to come together with so many versions, so many objects of the disease in this room, whether it's food or money or sex or alcohol or drugs, because you really get to see how the disease is there and the object, you know, is interchangeable. But there's this dis-ease, right? So I was thinking about this third step prayer for the talk and realized that it had actually been a really long time since I had gone back and read it in the formal way in the big book. It's just been a really long time since that language has rang home for me. But what I realized is that my version of it, that's just in the spirit of the prayer, is something like, relieve me of the bondage of self that I might be of service. You know, so someone mentioned today, take away my difficulties. I think of it more as, for myself, that what the language in the big book points to for me is an intention setting. That there isn't actually someone or something outside of myself taking away my difficulties, because that just creates this huge possibility of separation. There's this I, this me, that gets really like compact. And then there's this mysterious other somewhere. I think of it more as directing the mind towards a habit of pattern that is pointing to taking away difficulties. Directing the mind towards a possibility of freedom from whatever the difficulties are. And that what I've discovered in this practice is that as we direct our minds anywhere, the universal conditions somehow line up, and my attention is more there to see where I'm directing my mind. So I said this to somebody in an interview today, if I'm directing my mind towards kindness, I just tend to see where the kindness is. And if I'm being unconscious and directing my mind, well, or not directing my mind at all, it's just totally unconscious, then it's more chaotic. There's not that power of a directed mind, power of intention. But it's also mysterious because I, of course, can't will anything to happen. As we know, you know, this disease of self-will run riot, right? It's like, run riot. Yeah. So that's not it either. So I was thinking about the Buddhist path and the 12-step path, and just how in both of them, to come to a spiritual awakening, there are steps that need to be taken that lead us to relief from the bondage of self and release from the bondage of self. And I was just really appreciating the dual process of both traditions, the 12 steps and Buddhism, about how with both of them, there's this rigorous investigation of the small sense of self. So, you know, in the 12-step tradition might be called our character defects, or when we do an inventory, we're really investigating, like, what are these habits of mind that make me up? And, you know, where are they unskillful? And then we do a positive inventory. Where are they skillful? Where are the aspects of self that are skillful? I actually find it really helpful to bring together from time to time inventories and retreat practice. And sometimes after a retreat, I will go home and do an inventory process. And it's not super formal the way I do it after a retreat. But what I notice and what someone else brought up today in the interview is how just naturally by doing this process, meditation, it's a practice of purification. And so, you know, our fears and our resentments and our selfishness and the whole ball of our so-called character defects are coming into illumination. And we're sitting with them and we're breathing with them and we're naming them by their true names, this mental noting practice. It's like fear. And in parentheses for me, like, for example, with fear, it's like noting fear, feeling it in the body, and then the parentheses would be, I see you. I really see you. It's not not that that's part of my mental note, but it's the spirit of compassion in the mental note. Instead of those mental notes that get really harsh and criticize it, fear, fear. So you can track how the mental notes speak to you while you're sitting and walking if you use them. And then the other process that's in play in both traditions is the deepening of connection of that which is greater than ourselves. And in both traditions, it's both the process of the work and it's the fruits of the work. And it's so powerful. You know, those of us who have the momentum of both traditions, we really got a double power. So I'm just feeling for myself right now how much gratitude I have for that double power. That I have these two really big toolkits in my life, and that I have two sets of amazing elders who show me how to use the tools and take them out. Beautiful thing to bring together. And so for both traditions, both the vigorous self-examination and the deepening connection with a power greater than ourselves, they really are the ground for our honesty, for our forgiveness, for our healing, and for our awakenings. And I always say awakenings, because in both traditions, it's not one awakening. It's so easy to think that it's like we're sitting here and nirvana. You know, I mean, even in the Buddhist tradition, it's not how it works. What a relief. So I wanted to share a teaching by one of the teachers that I've been working with a lot on my long retreats the last couple of years. It's Gil Fronsdale, and a couple of you have mentioned that you go to his center. He's just a very grounded, wise, compassionate being. So he gave this analogy once that I just loved that points to this, and he called it the analogy of the hand. He's a scholar, so he kind of has these titles for things. So this is the analogy of the hand. It's really great. So if you've got a hand, there's two sides to the hand, right? Okay, so I've got the palm, I've got the back, everyone agrees. And when I do this, you're seeing the palm, or excuse me, you're seeing the back. I'll really confuse you. Now you're seeing the palm. So we tend to focus on one or the other. When I'm looking at the back, I can't see the palm. When I'm looking at the palm, I can't see the back. But they meet, right? They're not actually separate. So where does the palm end? Where does the back begin? So we actually need them both to equal a hand. And so here's the analogy, is that one side of the hand is pointing to the freedom that's available to all of us in every single moment. And the other side of the hand is the focus is investigating the delusion or confusion that clouds our connection with the freedom that's available. So I don't know which one that would be. Think of it, probably delusion and freedom is how I would think of it. And then the other analogy is, you know, that one side is that which we hold on to, so it's the grasping. And then the other side of the hand is the release of the grasping. So that we need them both, that they meet, that we focus on one or the other, but that they're both there and we need them both. I really use that analogy as a practice and not just some wise words. So I was thinking about some of the confusions that can come up around this whole bondage of self and relief from the bondage of self. more from a Buddhist perspective. And the first thing I thought of was kind of this confusion that can come up, like, well, if there's release or relief from the bondage of self, does that mean that I have to have like a personality lobotomy? Do I have to cut like a big part of me out to, you know, be free from the bondage of self? You know, and we discover as we do our practice, the same thing can come up in the 12 steps, like, well, you know, how do I cut out this fear or this, you know, this rage? Do I have to, like, get rid of it somehow? You know, what do I do? This kind of confusion of getting rid of versus including. Or maybe actually better said, getting rid of and including. The bottom line that I see both in the rooms and in the Buddhist tradition is that before and after all of our spiritual awakenings, you know, we're essentially the same person. You know, we live the same life. You know, we have the same personal history. It's not like we can get the eraser and erase that out. It's all still there. And the change is the bondage. The change is actually the release of the craving, or the transformation of the craving, and that sometimes it's temporary and sometimes it's longer, and that there's the possibility of an absolute release. So we've all seen, you know, the old timers in the rooms. It's actually, it seems pretty common to me that, you know, the people in the rooms with, you know, 25 years or 35 years, you know, have a lot of wisdom and a lot of teachings to share with me and with us, you know, and have vibrant personalities. But there's often an ease, you know, there's often a happiness that wasn't there before, a sense of peace, increasing wisdom. So this release from the bondage of self. In the Buddhist tradition, I was thinking about my root teacher, and root teacher just means my primary teacher, the teacher that's the closest to my heart, because I'm privileged to have quite a number of teachers. My root teacher is Ajahn Jinmyeon, and he is Thai and practices in the forest tradition, in the same lineage as Ajahn Chah. And I met him a number of years ago and have been sitting with him ever since. And what fascinates me about him is that there is no clinging to his sense of self whatsoever, and yet he has this outrageous personality, and, you know, talks about opinions on things all the time, and, you know, he's just really, really juicy and vibrant. And those of you who know him, you know, he's known as kind of the empty, happy monk. It's his favorite teaching, is empty, empty, happy, happy. He doesn't speak very much English, so he's learned the most important teaching to say in English. And so he'll just sit up there and, you know, he'll be like chowing down candy while he's giving a Dharma talk, and, ooh, this tastes good. And he'll say, oh, you know, Ajahn Jinmyeon is really, he'll talk about himself in third person, and he'll say, you know, Ajahn Jinmyeon is really happy today, and I went and did this, and I thought it was great, and, you know, I. And if you listen to him and you don't know him, you just think he's going on and on and on about himself. And he'll tell these stories about himself that go on for hours. And when I say hours, I mean hours. And yet there's no bondage there. It's just, it's like the stories come out of him, and they live their life in the telling, and they pass away, and the next moment arises, and he's right there. There's just no clinging. And I think it's interesting with Ajahn Jinmyeon, because his childhood had tremendous suffering. To my knowledge, he wasn't an addict or an alcoholic, but he He lost his mother when he was a very young child, 6 years old, and his father had issues with money, with gambling, and an addiction, I think, and really disappeared from the family scene at that point. And so Ajahn Jivanian is an amazing being, I will couch this with that, but he found himself at 9 and 10 years old supporting his brothers and sisters. He developed a fishing business to make sure that everyone had enough to eat, and there he was as a child taking care of the family. You know, how familiar is this to so many of us who raised our parents and our siblings? And he said that he had a lot of fear and anger when he was a child, and that his, I believe it was his grandfather, taught him the loving kindness practice as an antidote to the fear, which is, and the anger, which is the Buddha recommends. Actually, loving kindness is an antidote to those two energies of fear and anger. And because of the conditions that make up Ajahn Jivanian, he quickly, you know, mastered the practice and noticed his character defects of fear and anger rapidly diminishing, and it goes on from there. But it's just a powerful story to me about freedom from the bondage of self, because even the folks that we think are just really, really as close to fully awake as is possible on the planet right now, you know, they too were working with the bondage of self and working with it in some similar ways that we're doing here. So another analogy of the suffering of the craving that we all work with as humans and as addicts is the analogy of holding on to a rope. So you've got a rope, and you know, rope is useful. You can use it to tie things and do things with, and it serves a function and, you know, useful thing to have. But the analogy, the way I think of it, it's not the way it is in the text exactly, but the way I think of it is, okay, so I'm holding onto this rope, just hanging out, using the rope, using it for whatever I need to use it for, and then change happens. Because change is one of those universal experiences on this realm, that everything is constantly changing. So a change comes, and something or somebody comes and pulls on my end of the rope. They need the rope. Maybe they asked for the rope, maybe they didn't ask for the rope. Suddenly I get really upset and I start holding on to the rope, right? And I'm getting scared and I'm getting angry and I'm holding on tighter and tighter and tighter. Well, you know what happens when you're in a tug of war with a rope. Any of you that have ever been in a tug of war with a rope, you get rope burn. It's really painful. It'll cut up your hands real good. To me, that really connects with how we get caught up in the sense of self. Because our personalities, our sense of self, they're a really useful tool. They serve an important function. If we walked around with personality lobotomies, things wouldn't get done. You know, I'm not quite sure how it would look. But to hold it lightly, so that when it gets pulled on in some way, that we're not getting rope burn. Because when we get into the self-cherishing and we hold on really tight, this is who I am, this is how I am, this is how I like things, you know, don't get in my way. We start holding on, holding on, holding on. Then we start pushing out and we start blaming everyone and everything for our problems. And, you know, we start acting addictively because it really hurts. And so we want to comfort ourselves. We want to get out of this disaster. You know, what's our habit to do? Act addictively. And we've made that habit strong. And so now we're making these strong habits of not acting addictively and releasing the rope so that we still have our sense of self, that we don't cling so tightly to it, that we can be teachable. I think it gives us room by doing that, that when we work the seventh step and with complete humility set the intention for whatever we need to be released to be released, then there's space for the next thing to come in when we release our hold. So thank goodness, you know, we're asked to turn it over before we're asked to humbly ask our shortcomings to be transformed or removed. Another interesting thing I've been reflecting on about grasping and craving and clinging is that the fact that within the very grasping is the possibility and potential for release. It's right there. It's not something other than. So another great analogy of one of my teachers is the analogy of the fist. So you can do this with me if you're an experiential type. And please don't do it if you have any kind of arm discomfort from computers or whatnot. So if you put your hand in a fist and you make it really tight and you just hold on to it and keep holding on to it and really, you know, maybe even close your eyes and just feel the sensation of contraction and grasping and holding on. So what I'm feeling is pressure and tightness and heat. It's becoming unpleasant. At a certain point, and I won't ask you to do this unless you're really curious, at a certain point, your hand will automatically start to let go, maybe just a little bit, which is so much like our practice in our program, and then a little bit more, and then, you know, you may still have it like this, but the fist, the tightness is released, and then it's just a hand in this posture. The difference between the fist and the release. So it's right there. I was thinking about how I practice in the spirit of this teaching of relieve me of the bondage of self, and how I bring it into my meditation so that it's not separate, so that it's not my program and my meditation practice, but it's just practicing waking up. And one example I actually got taught by a friend who meditates and is also in the program, and one retreat that she sat every single time that she reached the door of the meditation hall. And she was the type of person that liked to bow when she reached the door of the hall. Some of us do, some of us don't. So when she would bow at the door of the meditation hall, she would say those words to herself in her mind every single time she reached the door. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And she said it in that way when she reached her cushion. First of all, she said that it really, really got her present when she reached the door of the hall, that her sitting practice started right then, before she was even on the cushion. But also that it was a powerful intention practice for her, that she knew that when she reached the sitting posture and noticed her first in-breath, what her deepest intention was. You know, that noticing the next time she breathed in was in the service of release me from the bondage of self. And I think it's really powerful to connect with your intention in that way and regularly, because sometimes we can just do this for a number of days and, you know, we sort of just plop ourselves down and, okay, I'm supposed to be following the breath or noticing sensations. We kind of forget why we're doing it, you know? I mean, so what? I noticed I breathe, you know? So I really liked that practice when she told me about it. And so I took it on for myself for a period of time and also just as I said, found it extremely helpful in that way. The second practice is also a bit of a saying or an intention practice that I do for myself, actually now both on and off retreat. So it's moved from the retreat world out into the whole world. And it's just a simple phrase that I use a lot to remind me what I'm doing in practice. And it's the phrase of bow to that which got me here. Rest in that which I am. Bow to that which got me here. Rest in that which I am. And even just saying those words, I can feel for myself the resonance in the body that that they're words and yet they're internal movements that happen for me when I say them. So I'll say a little bit about what they mean to me. Bow to that which got me here is really acknowledging that whether you call them character defects, whether you call them just, you know, unresolved childhood issues, you know, if you call them, whatever you call them, these habits of mind that actually aren't serving us anymore, but had an extremely important function when they got created. They saved our lives, literally. You know, the fears, the layers of protection, you know, the vulnerability, the shame, all of it. Just, you know, it was created to save ourselves at a time when we needed it. And then there's a time when, you know, they can turn into more self-destructive habits and behaviors, and we don't need them anymore, and we grow up, and you know, it's time to wave goodbye. It's time to let go. But to let go of them in the spirit of, you know, sending a child off to college with great love and respect for, you know, for everything that they did to get themselves there. So for me, I'm bowing to my own character defects that way. And I know that some people have a lot of resistance to bowing in general, or even that idea. So it doesn't have to be a literal thing. It's an internal bow. It's an internal acknowledgement, as it were. So to really, really, with just great love and respect, you know, it's like the Rumi poem from yesterday, right? Let's see if I can find it. You know, even if there are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be cleaning you out for some new delight. So as the fear and anxiety and anger and self-judgment and all that violently sweep through our minds, you know, to internally bow. To say, I see you, I bow to you because you got me here, you got me to this point. And then opening even further into resting in that which I am. So you can call that God. You could call it awareness. You could call it the unconditioned nature of our true minds, Buddha nature. You could just call it nature. So everyone has a different relationship, but that's the spirit, to bow to the challenges and then to drop down and rest in that which is greater than ourselves. So it's a dual movement that includes everything. It includes that which I'm caught, that which I'm in bondage to, and it includes that which is greater than all that, where there's rest and peace and true happiness. And it's a movement. It's like a dance. It's not like spiritual awakening. I mean, this is something that I practice with continuously. So especially when the really key ones pop up, like for me, fear is just one that pops up a lot. You know, my mind has a habit of fear. It's conditioned. I've fed it for many years. So it just pops up a lot. Just sometimes it's about something. Sometimes it's just random fear. It's like, oh, bow to that which got me here. There's a reason that fear is so strong in my mind. You know, for me, the growing up years were scary. It fed fear. But then to bow and then rest, it's like, okay, the fear can be held in the vastness of a spacious heart, in awareness. So this resting in a power greater than ourselves, the way I'm speaking of it, is not separate. It's not other. It's not me and something else. It's all one. I want to end with another quote by Ajahn Sumedho. There is no peace to be found in the creation of Sumedho, in the creation of self. Peace is to be found in awareness. Try bringing up the self and see. Watch it create itself. Know it thoroughly. Then put it down. Let it go. And rest in awareness. So I invite us to sit together for a minute and just feel the impact, whatever it is, of these words in the body and in the heart. And as Ajahn Sumedho invites us, try bringing up the self and see. Watch it create itself. Know it thoroughly. And then put it down. Let it go. Rest.